This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Rex Huerman.
In many true crime cases, the origin story doesn't begin with the crime scene. It begins with a rescue, a moment where someone, usually a man, steps into a woman's life at her most vulnerable and appears to save her. But sometimes that rescue is the beginning of a different kind of captivity. Think back to Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka in Canada. At first, he was the charming, handsome boyfriend who helped her escape a strict upbringing, but behind closed doors, he was grooming her into complicity. Or Chris Watts, who seemed like the perfect husband until his entire family vanished. Their wives and families didn't fall in love with monsters. They fell in love with someone who presented as their protector. And in this segment, we're going to dive into the early years of Rex Huerman and Asa Ellerup's relationship, the origin story. What began as friendship and support during a bitter divorce turned into a family unit, a home, a child, and perhaps a carefully constructed illusion. What Robin Dreek exposes here is not just a behavioral breakdown of Rex, it's an exploration of why Asa may have never asked the right questions and how her emotional needs, past traumas, and empathetic nature may have been the very traits that made her the perfect cover. As we peel back the layers of their relationship, how they met, how they lived, and how their home was shaped, we begin to understand the difference between a life shared and a life staged. In the comments section, let me know what you think on YouTube about all of this. If you're listening to us on the podcast platforms, hit subscribe there so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case. And do check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Just search that. And like I said, tell us what you think. Yeah, I got a lot of questions, and including some about that secret place. But let's watch some of the clips, and we'll kind of get into some of those because we're going to see the secret place. We're going to see all sorts of interesting things about what went on.
Creepy shit
but
there, boy.
Let's start out at the beginning. This is how she met Rex, because it kind of sets the scene for everything that goes on afterwards. This, again, is from the documentary
I
special.
I moved here in Peacock with Rex in November of 1995. Oh, that's my favorite. I met Rex when I was 18 years old. He was going to college. I was working at 7-Eleven. I was born in Iceland. My younger brother was adopted to an Icelandic family. And I was adopted to America. But because of that, I traveled a lot to Iceland with my family and Rex. He traveled a lot. He went on archaeological digs. He's the kind of guy you turn your head and you go take a look at, you know? He was tall, handsome, debonair young man. I love tall, dark, and handsome. That's me. And at that time, I was madly in love with the man. There's no doubt about that. But then I met my first husband and got married. But things did not go well at all. After my son Christopher was born, my ex-husband became somebody completely different. I was in the process of getting a divorce. Christopher's father, he wasn't very nice about it. He said to me, there's no way in the world he was going to be okay with me being happy with somebody else. Rex was the kind of person that you could call, even if you just wanted to talk, and that's it. We were friends. Everybody needs a friend. So Rex came with me one time to go pick up my son. Rex was standing there, and he heard what he said. Rex then says, okay, I'm not worried. Let's get a lawyer. Let's take him to court. And then he paid for the lawyer to take him to court. So fast forward I got my divorce, there was no reason to hold back. You know what I mean? So Rex said to me, I've got a nice house. I mean, it's not big, not elaborate. How about you come and see if you'd like to stay there? I'm like, yes, I would love to. And then I found out I was pregnant with Rex's baby. And he said to me, well, how do you feel about marrying me? And I said, yes. There's a picture of me, and I'm looking up going, I finally got him. He's mine.
She still seems to have that same vigor about her of, he's mine. Everybody needs a friend, right? Lot to unpack there. I'm just going to go with you. What stood out to you?
Watching it again that time, there's one statement she said. There's a lot of statements in there. Yeah. You can obviously see. I mean, if you didn't know what you know now about him, you're like, wow, what a great guy.
Yeah, I mean, they look like a normal, like, if you look at what they are today and you look at those pictures from 1995, it looks like pretty much any normal couple's wedding, family photos.
It does. And here's something to kind of go to what I was saying about why he selected her. Again, was it a conscious choice because he wanted to use her to cover his horrible tracks? I just think it's intuitive. I think it was an attractiveness. And here's the attractiveness part. She said her ex-husband turned into somebody different.
Uh-huh.
She lacked curiosity through that entire life arc. So in other words, she was unable to see anything that's presented deeper than the surface.
Yeah.
I don't like using that word gullible because it kind of I don't like demeaning anyone or mm-hmm. like victim blaming in this, but she doesn't have a deeper curiosity to understand why people have the actions they have. She takes people on their surface. I mean, it's a very endearing quality people have, you know. But at the same time, it made her susceptible to predators.
Yeah,
and the first husband was a predator from at least took advantage of her, mm-hmm. dumped her, and left.
Yeah.
And she didn't see it coming, turned into a different person. And what happened a second time? Turned into a different person. She's completely and still doesn't believe.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a big part of that. I was wondering about that because she was able to recognize bad behavior at one point in time, it seems. But nothing beyond it really much until Rex comes in and says, well, let's do something about this. And who knows? I have no idea what her situation was. Maybe the idea of getting an attorney at the time was just unattainable, you know, financially.
7-Eleven.
Yeah. So there probably wasn't a lot of options. It's that X kind of had her where he wanted her in terms of control financially and all of that. Then Rex comes in as the savior. I got this house. You know, I can be this father. We already are, you know, we're friends and this could turn into something. And I mean, it seems like if you have pure intent, okay, that's how some nice relationships begin, you know, coming out of some, you know, darkness and everybody kind of getting their stuff together and we're a happy family unit and it works. Mm-hmm. Unless it's Rex Huerman and he already allegedly has killed somebody 3 years prior to you meeting. So there's a lot in there. But the no curiosity, there's just so many questions.
And she's also, you know, in nursing, you know, my daughter being a nurse too. Yeah. I mean, these are people that are also, you know, biologically geared for empathy and taking mm-hmm. care of others and that whole embracing aspect of it. You know, a lot of nurses do nursing because they don't want to be doctors because it gets a little too clinical. They like mm-hmm. being close to patients.
Yeah.
They like taking care of others, you know, and that just emanates from her. You know, regarding the kids, the family aspect of things, traveling to Iceland for family. I mean, here's a woman, you know, that's working at 7-Eleven with not much money, yet it seems, you know, again, let's take that intuitive leap, you know, doing these trips to Iceland and I can tell you, I've been there. It's the most expensive place I've ever been in the entire world.
Really?
Oh my God, it's horrendous because everything's got to be flown in.
Sure.
All they grow there is tomatoes, you know, in the thermals around the volcanoes. So it's an expensive place to live, expensive place to visit. It's just very congruent with the empathy aspect of things, not curious, just taking care of others, being taken advantage of by some. You know, her ex-husband just didn't have the reps in hiding secret life that Rex had when they met. And so it was a, it was a great choice by him for what he wanted to do.
What do you make of the archaeological digs? That's kind of an interesting
It's kind of
one.
Creepy, wasn't it? He's like, oh, where did this start from? Like, I mean, he's got odd habits, doesn't he?
He does.
He's got some odd. There's not a lot. I really tried to research his parents, his upbringing, these types of things. Like my first thing I saw was he bought his parents' house. How many other serial killers that bought their parents' house, BTK did.
Yeah.
Because I was curious on that, because control that environment is so, it's not a huge amount. It has happened, but not a huge amount, because that's the first thing that really struck me. Why would you buy your parents' house? What's going on there? And then also, no improvements to it, very, very limited improvements. I mean, the place is run down. That's what sparked my curiosity. And I'm like, does he have money? Does that take money? Does he not use his money? Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at the health of Asa. He's definitely not paying health insurance for dental insurance or anything on her. No. I mean, you know, it's kind of sad. It's like, what are you doing with your time and money? Yeah. It's not the house. It's not healthcare. There, see what I mean? And she wasn't curious about it.
Well, and it was so normalized. So she didn't even realize just how strange it was that these somewhat basic things were not being taken care of, because she comes from a place where she was adopted to America, you know, that so that whole, you know, familial connection is kind of different. So you get that she's led a kind of rough life growing up, abuse, rape. There was a lot that woman went through.
And there's no materialistic, you know, aspect to her. It doesn't seem like what it is all to her is emotional. She keeps going to that family. And he was providing family for her.
Yeah.
She had her children. She's close to her children. I mean, so all her needs, you know, people balance the needs emotionally and physically and materialistically all very differently. And you can see her needs are being met emotionally, and that's what Rex was able to do.
Yeah.
And he also is not a very materialistic guy, because look at the wreck in which he lived. Mm-hmm. I mean, just crazy, especially in Long Island where they lived. That's a little off.
I wonder about the house. We'll talk more about the house in a minute. Let's take a look at her showing off some of the house. This is her giving a tour of the gun room. This is very close to and part of Rex's lair, basically, in the basement that we've been hearing about. Locked off with a vault door, which I don't know. I mean, it's kind of odd in your basement. I've seen some people do it with gun rooms, but I don't know. It's a little odd. Let's take a look.
This is the steel door. It had a combination lock. It's this lever here. It's a very easy way to get out, so no one can get locked in here. Now, this is the room where he displayed his firearms collection.
So the famous gun room, when I sat there, I recall vividly that he said, in 30 years, you're the fourth person to ever be in this room. And I was like, wow. And that's when he showed me his collection. See, he started collecting rifles and all kinds of guns early on when he was 18. And it was an amazing collection.
There's nothing in this case that suggests that those guns were utilized in the commission of any crime.
A walk-in gun vault, that's one thing. But a secret room? I was like, oh my God.
According to a colleague of Rex Huerman's, he had a room specifically built in his basement that even his wife was not allowed to enter.
That's the secret room everybody talks about.
It's kind of a walk-in closet in the gun room that is actually right under the stairs.
He didn't want anybody to have access to it, the secret room, so nobody would know, not because he was hiding anything, but because he wanted to secure a safe in there.
And I actually didn't see what the inside of it actually looked like until after all this happened. I couldn't get in there myself.
All completely normal behavior, right? normalized, but yeah, not normal.
If that's what you grow up with. That's normal behavior. And also, from what I understand, too, it's also his childhood bedroom.
Yes. And that's a point I want to get to on this, because I think there's something to that. And I think it plays into the why the house has never been updated, why it still looks like 1965 in that.
Can't have contractors in there tearing shit apart.
No, you can't. But I wonder if there's a level of him finding peace in the familiarity of childhood, because essentially if he goes back into that basement, which was his childhood bedroom, and it's this kind of like safe, happy place, it makes you wonder what was going on in childhood with Rex too. What was going on in that basement? Was there something going on in that basement, or were those like happy, pure times before he got into this dark road? Or, you know, was he always kind of doing some stuff down there that was kind of off, that he kept secret from the rest of society, but it still has a element of comfort because it is from childhood, and he was able to kind of weave in this darkness that he got into in adulthood into a safe place, and then it all kind of normalized it for him in life. Psychologically.
I think all of it, Tony. Yeah. I think these are all parts of a whole. I mean, so let's take a look, you know, by comparison of current cases. And again, they're both innocent until proven guilty. But you look at a Brian Koberger, without actually, we don't have to place his name, but someone like him who's a curious serial killer, gives you a much different vibe. There's someone who's really, really with a broken brain, trying to seek out something, some sensations to give him a sense of fulfillment. I get a different feeling and a tenor from Huerman. And I just get the feeling that these are half of these behaviors he's doing were learned behaviors. I don't necessarily think he was like born doing a lot of this weird shit that typically pure broken brain people do. Mm-hmm. I think half of it was learned. I think maybe coping mechanisms he was having, because from what I understand, he was bullied pretty decently growing up, and safe places, psychological comfort from being in the bedroom that, you know, that you grew up in. And the other thing that struck me too is only four people to visit the gun vault in his gun collection. So here's what's kind of striking about that too. Years ago, there's a good book that was put out. I can't remember the author's name, but the book is called Snoop. Mm-hmm. And what Snoop talks about is what our stuff says about us. In other words, things we have on display. Like, for example, you know, behind me here, I have my books. I got my retired FBI creds. I got pictures of my kids. These things I have displayed for you, the world. I got my Marine Corps emblem here. I mean, they mean things to me, but these are things I project out to the world because they're what I want you to see as part of who I am to make a whole. And now here's the interesting thing. What he said was only four people have seen this gun vault. In other words, he didn't have this collection for his persona he's projecting to the world. This was his enjoyment for himself. Mm-hmm. That's a lot different than what people generally typically put out there. So he got his self enjoyment from that gun collection. So that whole room and that whole complex and small downstairs, I call it a complex, but that whole small secret place downstairs was purely for his psychological comfort. No one else's. That was his secret place to feel good about himself.
I want to read that book. Sam Gosling, by the way, is the author of Snoop. That looks really interesting because I have all sorts of stuff around here. You can't see it on camera. But yeah, I mean, I'd be really curious to learn about that. I have all sorts of I have a lot of childhood stuff over here on the wall. I have in my childhood, I was working in radio. I have mic flags. I have all sorts of radio stuff. I have Ghostbuster stuff. I have things that my grandfather gave me. Like I have a bowling a Jim Beam bowling pin where the top comes off. And it was, I remember him showing that to me as a child. I'm like, oh, this is so neat, a bowling pin. And it's actually when he was
all part of the arc, Tony. That's why, you know, one of the questions I asked you, you know, together, working together, you know, for everyone else listening, it's like, hey, what was that inspiration all those years ago that helped Tony be who he is today?
Yeah.
And that's all these things that we hold on to are part of that arc.
The stuff tells a lot. Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
And then it's not just, it tells a lot, but it tells us what we want others to see it too. So what you'll see in Gosling's book is that you look at the, like if you go to someone's office or like this is my home office, where are the angles? Are they angled for me? Or are they angled for you?
Mm-hmm.
And that tells you what is this, what someone is trying to project, or is it something they're using for themselves? And so it's really, again, there's no right or wrong here. Yeah. It's just assessing part of understanding everyone. So all these things that Rex had was not about other people consuming what he had. It was all purely for him. Because this was not a show house. He didn't have what appears a show job.
Yeah.
Dollhouse, again, that dollhouse to me is really striking because he's a crafted, you know, a gifted craftsman, a woodworker. You know, he had habits and collections that I saw as really pretty different from what we've seen from others. Because one of the things I was also looking at is how was he able to placate himself in between kills? In between murders that he was using for his own gratification. I think that's why he had such extreme, what might, at least to me, seem more extreme collections and extreme hobbies, because he really needed that level in order to do that. The soliciting prostitutes, that's an extreme behavior. Stalking prostitutes, extreme behavior. Yeah. Huge, massive gun collections, going to rifle ranges, extreme behaviors. So... Mm-hmm. Really interesting.
Yeah, and especially, and we'll take a listen to some of the clips of the daughter in just a little bit, because she's really conflicted about this. I mean, she had in her mind, a normal dad who would build a dollhouse for her, who would spend time with her, who would do things. And as she describes it, you can love him and you can hate him at the same time, because she's trying to reconcile childhood with what reality is. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. Thank you so much. What we've just explored with Robin isn't just a story of a secret room in a basement. It's a story of psychological architecture. How someone like Rex Huerman allegedly built a world so carefully designed that no one thought to open the wrong door. That gun room, that vault, that was a sanctuary, not built for protection, built for privacy. A place where the life he lived and the life he hid could coexist without ever touching. And Asa, whether by trauma, temperament, or design, may have been someone who never wanted to knock on the locked door in her basement, especially if the man behind it once rescued her from an even darker chapter in her life. There's something chilling about how ordinary this story begins. A young woman working at a 7-Eleven, a college student who offered her kindness, a family formed around what seemed like mutual support. When you look closely, what emerges isn't a love story. It's a behavioral pattern. A woman who had been hurt before. A man with secrets he needed to protect. And an emotional contract they both entered into. One seeking safety, the other seeking cover. It makes us all the more unsettling is how easily this could have been anybody's story. Most people don't end up married to a monster. They end up married to someone who makes them feel seen, safe, and understood until it's too late. Tell me what your thoughts are in the comment section on YouTube about what you just saw. Would love to hear that. Hit subscribe on YouTube as well. If you're listening to us on a podcast platform, hit subscribe there first so you don't miss any of it. Then do please check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, so you can join in that conversation on this subject. Until next time, I am Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. We will talk again real soon.
Want true crime coverage all day, every day? Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today and get the latest cases delivered right to your feed.